Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Former Officials Outline FBI Investigation Process press call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode, and later you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note that today's call may be recorded, and I will be standing by should you need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Kristen Voorhees. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Kristen Voorhees. I'm the Communications Manager here at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Thanks again for joining us for our Former Officials Outline FBI Investigation Process on SCOTUS nominees call. All of the speakers have extensive experience working on judicial nominations and are looking forward to expressing their remarks regarding this current judicial nominations FBI background investigation on Brett Kavanaugh. First, it is my pleasure to turn over the call to Christine Lucius, Executive Vice President of Policy here at the Leadership Conference and former top legal and policy advisor to Senator Leahy for the Senate Judiciary Committee. Christine?
Good afternoon and thank you. I am the Executive Vice President of Policy at the Leadership Conference, a coalition of more than 200 national organizations working to build an America as good as its ideals. From the moment Brett Kavanaugh was nominated to the Supreme Court, Chairman Chuck Grassley and his all-male Republican colleagues on the Senate Judiciary Committee have been in such a rush to confirm their party's nominee that they have overridden the committee's own rules and norms and protocols. I know this because for more than 14 years, I served as a counsel to Senator Patrick Leahy on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I worked on countless judicial nominations, including six Supreme Court nominations. The most recent violation by Republican leadership concerns the supplemental FBI investigation into allegations of sexual assault against Brett Kavanaugh. This was finally requested by the White House last Friday. After weeks of ignoring calls by Senate Judiciary Committee Democrats to reopen the investigation, the White House finally made the request at the behest of Senator Jeff Flake. And despite claims from the president that the White House did not limit the scope of the investigation, there is troubling evidence that a number of key witnesses have not been interviewed. Recent reports indicate that neither Dr. Christine Blasey Ford nor Brett Kavanaugh himself have been interviewed by the FBI. During my time on the Senate Judiciary Committee, I cannot remember any supplemental investigation in which the FBI did not interview the person who brought forth the allegations and the nominee himself. That has been and must remain a minimum baseline for credibility. No senator should even consider proceeding unless and until the investigation by the FBI is determined to be thorough and unfettered. Ranking Member Feinstein has asked for it to be made public what the directive to the FBI is, and there should be no reason why that directive is not made public. 27 years ago, during Anita Hill's hearing, we learned a critically important lesson, which is that corroborating witnesses are necessary to any meaningful consideration by the Senate Judiciary Committee. A number of Kavanaugh's former classmates have said publicly that they have information to share with the FBI, but there's a major problem. The witnesses cannot make contact with the FBI or get their calls returned by the FBI. And many are beginning to wonder if this is a real supplemental investigation or a sham process. One such witness is Yale classmate of Debbie Ramirez and Kavanaugh, who says he's 100% certain that he heard about the party and the assault that Ramirez alleges during college. Elizabeth Razor is another key witness that has been reported on in the press. She's the college girlfriend of Mark Judge and has evidence that contradicts the portrait of that Judge Kavanaugh painted under oath in his confirmation hearing last Thursday. Meanwhile, on the committee, Republicans have deliberately and viciously created a situation of he said, she said by refusing to call any witnesses who can corroborate Dr. Blasey Ford's story. And the FBI, if they refuse to interview other credible witnesses, it will be very revealing that the investigation was not legitimate or thorough. Republicans are silencing survivors. And it's clear they're not serious about getting to the truth of Kavanaugh's alleged offenses against women or his lying under oath. Indeed, Trump's shameless, despicable mocking of Dr. Blasey Ford at a rally last night disgraces the office he occupies, but it also insults all survivors of sexual assault. So the question is, what are senators going to do about it? It's unfortunate that not only did President Trump mock Dr. Blasey Ford last night, but now at least one Republican senator has also taken to Twitter to insult her as well. Now the question is whether the FBI investigation will exacerbate the sham process that Republican senators have done. Senators must ensure that the FBI conducts a thorough and independent investigation by interviewing all relevant witnesses about sexual assaults and whether Kavanaugh lied under oath. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. Now we will hear from Mike Zubrinsky, Chief Counsel at the Leadership Conference and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Policy at the U.S. Department of Justice. Mike?
Thanks, Kristen. My name is Mike Zubrinsky and am the Chief Counsel of the Leadership Conference, and as Kristen mentioned, worked for nearly 7 years as the Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Policy, where I supervised the vetting of over 300 of President Obama's judicial nominees. And when credible allegations of sexual assault against Brett Kavanaugh became public a few weeks ago, many of us with knowledge of the FBI background investigation process urged the Trump administration to open a supplemental investigation. Only after Senators Flake and Coons negotiated a deal last Friday did the White House finally ask the FBI to investigate. However, reports that the FBI has failed to interview key witnesses, as Christine discussed, and the reports that they could wrap up their investigation as early as today strongly suggest that this investigation will lack legitimacy. Here are my three main concerns about the process. First, President Trump seems to have placed severe restrictions on what the FBI can investigate. Now, he has denied that publicly, but as we know with President Trump, you have to trust but verify. Now, when I was working with another speaker on today's call, Chris Kang, who served as Deputy White House Counsel, we would make these types of supplemental investigation requests to the FBI, and we never once placed restrictions on who the FBI could contact. There may have been instances in which we would suggest specific people that we knew had information that was relevant to the investigation, and we would encourage the FBI to contact them, but we never muzzled the FBI in the way that appears the White House is doing today. We let them follow the evidence. Ranking Member Feinstein of the Judiciary Committee has called on the White House to publicly release its directions to the FBI, but the White House has so far refused to do so. Now, these White House directions to the FBI, these are not part of the FBI report. The report itself is a confidential document, but the instructions to the FBI as to what to investigate, that is not part of the FBI report and does not get transmitted to the Senate. And therefore, that should be made public. And we support Senator Feinstein's request that that be made public in order to enhance the legitimacy and the transparency of this process. A second concern I have is with the artificial one-week deadline. Now, 1 week is not enough time to really do a thorough investigation of the allegations made by Dr. Blasey Ford, Deborah Ramirez, Julie Swetnick, and all the individuals who have publicly challenged Brett Kavanaugh's credibility. There was one report this morning that 40 individuals with relevant information have not yet been contacted by the FBI. No one will have faith that this investigation is legitimate if appropriate witnesses are not all interviewed. And my third concern is that this investigation should have been conducted before and not after the hearing last week with Kavanaugh and Dr. Blasey Ford. That way, the committee could have used as the foundation for its questioning and also for selecting additional witnesses. And that's what happened for the Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas hearing in 1991, as Christine also discussed. Republicans cannot claim that there was no corroboration of Dr. Blasey Ford's claims when they themselves suppressed corroborative evidence from being heard. Now, despite my concerns about the FBI investigation, I still think it will be important for all 100 senators to review the FBI report once it's complete and made available. Now, it's deeply disturbing that Majority Leader McConnell has pledged to vote on Kavanaugh this week before the FBI report is even finished and before senators have the chance to review it. Now, in my experience vetting hundreds of judicial nominees, the FBI only produced one copy, one hard copy of the FBI report for each nominee. And this report would go from the FBI to my office at the Justice Department to the White House and then to the Senate. And the memorandum of understanding that governs the handling of these FBI reports, this MOU was made public for the first time yesterday when Senator Grassley tweeted it out. This MOU precludes any photocopying of FBI reports and any creation of electronic copies. So senators are forced to share the one hard copy. And given the consequences and the stakes of this nomination and this vote, all 100 senators should want to review this FBI report carefully to make credibility assessments. And this will take time. And because the FBI report's a confidential document that cannot be made public or discussed with anyone outside the Senate, senators will only have the ability to discuss its specific contents with each other and a handful of authorized staff, like Christine when she worked for Senator Leahy. Now, McConnell's decision to force a vote this week on the Kavanaugh nomination will likely deprive senators of a meaningful opportunity to review and evaluate the FBI report if it's even finished by the time of the vote. This rushed process is beneath the world's greatest deliberative body, and as Christine mentioned, part of a pattern of abuse that has occurred by Republican leadership during the course of this confirmation process and really over the past year and a half, involving other judicial nominees as well. Senator Flake and his Senate colleagues, who have not yet decided how to vote on the Kavanaugh nomination, should insist that McConnell respect the confirmation process. And they should demand that the FBI take the time it needs to conduct a thorough and meaningful investigation. Only if the FBI is permitted to conduct such an investigation can it adequately inform a senator's decision whether Kavanaugh deserves a job promotion to our nation's highest court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Now we will hear from Chris Kang, Chief Counsel at Demand Justice and former Deputy Counsel to President Obama. Chris?
Thanks, and thanks everybody for joining us today. I am Chief Counsel of Demand Justice, which is one of the organizations along with Leadership Conference and a whole coalition of organizations leading the fight to oppose Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. And I just wanted to take a half a second to reflect on this FBI background investigation as just another example of the White House using its power to protect Brett Kavanaugh and to hide the truth from the Senate and from the American people. Remember, we had this issue just last month around the National Archives and the usual process for it to produce the nominees' papers from the White House with respect to Supreme Court nominees. So far, the National Archives has produced 0 pages of Brett Kavanaugh's 3 million White House records. Not only 0 pages from the staff secretary time that Grassley would not even request, but even none of the 900,000 pages that Senator Grassley himself did request. And I think that it's important to tie these two together because it just shows part of the pattern. It shows part of the length that this White House and the Republican Senate will go to hide Brett Kavanaugh's record, to prevent the Senate from having the information it needs to really consider this nomination, and just how far it's willing to go to break the norms and traditions and practices and really the usual procedures that we would expect to see, not only for a Supreme Court nominee, but for any nominee. Right, Mike just talked about what the usual process is for an FBI investigation and for a supplemental investigation, which again is very routine. I authorized dozens of supplemental background investigations. The fact that it took this dramatic moment during a Judiciary Committee markup at the last minute for Senator Flake to say we need a supplemental background investigation is in and of itself extraordinary and a sign of the broken process, because this should have been routine. And now we have a timeline that's too short and a witness list that is much too small. And I think that the witness list, being as narrow as it is, sort of focuses on one of the key questions that I have that I don't understand is how this process is working, right? It was originally reported that the White House gave the FBI for a list of four names that they could interview. And as Mike said, that's never how the process works. The process could say, start with these people, but go wherever the evidence leads. Right, where I think we're going to hear from Frank about how the process is supposed to work, how it usually works, but it certainly was never only taught to these people. But now we're starting to see the White House give mixed messages about what the FBI agents are allowed to see. We're seeing some reporting that maybe the FBI agents are interviewing more people, but we don't know how these people are being chosen. I have real questions about whether or not the FBI is pre-screening these witnesses, talking to them before they're clearing the FBI to interview them as part of this investigation. Is that why we've only seen Brett Kavanaugh's high school friends confirm that they've been interviewed in this process and not the witnesses and recommenders that Dr. Ford and Ms. Ramirez have provided? Look at that NBC News piece that talks this morning about the 30 or 40 other witnesses who have not been contacted yet. Dr. Ford's therapist hasn't been contacted yet. The polygraph examiner, who she's been asking to testify at the hearing and has been putting forward for weeks now, has not been interviewed yet. You have somebody from Ms. Ramirez's time at Yale who says, I have evidence which would be helpful to the investigation. He hasn't been contacted. David White is somebody who they say it's plausible that he is the one who ran down the hallway and yelled that Kavanaugh put his penis in Ms. Ramirez's face. He hasn't been interviewed. Dr. Ford hasn't been interviewed. Judge Kavanaugh hasn't been interviewed. When Republicans keep saying there's no corroborating evidence to these claims, testimony is evidence. And I think the fact that they're limiting this testimony, they're limiting these interviews, is incredibly concerning. But it's not only the scope of the witnesses that I think is problematic. I think it's the scope about what the FBI agents are going to be allowed to ask about that is incredibly concerning. They need to investigate whether or not Brett Kavanaugh lied. I had an op-ed in Politico earlier this week with Brian Fallon, the executive director of Demand Justice, talking about Brett Kavanaugh's yearbook. And on the one hand, I think people are quick to dismiss this idea that the FBI should be questioning what Devil's Triangle is or what boofing meant, as if they're sort of comical. And of course, high school boys will be high school boys. We're not asking for a cross-examination about whether or not what he put in his yearbook when he was 18 was appropriate. We're asking whether he lied about it to the Senate when he gave testimony under oath, because that is perjury, that is disqualifying. And even if you don't consider it perjury, even if people say, well, of course he's gonna lie about these embarrassing things from high school, we'll give him a pass, that goes to the very credibility of what he's saying. It's not only he said, she said, as Republicans like to try to put this, it's he said, she said, and these dozens of witnesses that would corroborate what she said in the case of Dr. Ford and Ms. Ramirez, and also whether or not what he said is true, whether or not he is credible. This is not a question about whether or not Brett Kavanaugh drank to excess in high school or in college. It's a question about whether or not he's credible when he tells everybody now that the only thing he did in high school was focus on his studies and going to church and athletics. And I think that we need corroborating witnesses to tell us. If you produce a bunch of people that tell us that the Devil's Triangle was a drinking game in college, in high school that they used to play, that could support his credibility. But if nobody verifies that, that undermines it. And I think that that's incredibly important. And so while we have these questions about the scope of the witnesses and the scope of what the FBI asked, I think it's clear that we are not going to have confidence in this FBI background investigation. It's not just that, as Mike said, we have to make the White House directions public. I think we do. It's not just that there has to be some summary made public, which is what some senators are talking about now. I think the whole thing needs to be subject, right? These FBI background investigations are even subject to FOIA with some restrictions, but there's no question that this needs to be released here. Let's see who they interviewed. Let's see the questions they asked, and let's see whether or not they really examined Kavanaugh's duty of candor, whether or not he was honest, whether or not he's a credible witness in making his defense. The final point I wanted to raise here, because I don't think it's been talked about anywhere, and I think it's important as we talk about how long ago this was and what happened, is I want to remind folks that during the entire Obama administration, and I think it may even be a rule now, although Grassley has talked about loosening it, a single time using cocaine or any drug other than marijuana, a single time using drugs after the age of 18 was disqualifying for somebody to be a federal judge. So we had candidates who may have gotten drunk at a college party when they were 18 and tried cocaine once, automatically disqualified. We have candidates who turned 18 in high school and may have used mushrooms, automatically disqualified. Right? The idea then that Brett Kavanaugh can commit sexual assault by exposing himself to Deborah Ramirez when he is in college, and that's not disqualifying, is appalling to me, and it's incredibly hypocritical. And these people that we interviewed, we talked to, who one admitted what they did to the FBI, even though the chances of somebody coming forward and saying that they used cocaine when they were 18 once at a party is infinitely small. They came forward, they told the truth, they talked about how that experience changed their lives and how they've used it to become better people, better lawyers, potentially better judges. Those people were kicked out of the process. And for Brett Kavanaugh to be allowed to move forward here with these credible allegations because somebody wants to dismiss it as something that just happened in college, I think is incredibly hypocritical. And I think is a key part that needs to be teased out for how Republicans treat background investigations and what they think is important and what isn't.
Thank you, Chris. Finally, we'll hear from Frank Figliuzzi, Chief Operating Officer at ETS Risk and Director for Counterintelligence, former FBI Chief Inspector, and former Special Agent in charge of the Cleveland Field Office. Frank?
Thanks very much. As has been said, I was the former FBI Assistant Director for Counterintelligence, the former FBI Chief Inspector, and now currently lead ETS Risk Management that does complex background investigations. I think my message today, if I were to synopsize it, would be this, that the existing background investigation protocols between the White House and the FBI regarding presidential appointees are flawed and need to be reexamined. When the White House can actually prevent the nation's premier investigative agency from fully determining the suitability of a Supreme Court nominee, we've got a problem. So that needs to be addressed in the longer term. Let's talk about the reality of real time. By starting with talking about what is normal and what is not normal about what we're seeing today. So you've heard, and I need to reemphasize because I fear greatly that the FBI is going to end up in a trap that's been laid by the White House, where they will be pointed to as having done a fulsome investigation when the reality is they've not. So let me reiterate that unlike anything else the FBI does for a living, a background investigation, or in this case, a special inquiry called a SPIN, is unlike anything the FBI does. And everything else the FBI does, criminal, national security work, the client is the American people. In background investigations, as has been discussed, per protocol, per MOU, the client is the White House or the requesting agency of for the appointment. And there's a flaw there because it's essentially like hiring a private detective agency to follow your cheating spouse. You work for your client, you do what they want, and they shape the outcome. And we need to re-examine that. What's going on right now is in a reopening, in my experience, 25 years with the FBI, there are real-time updates being provided to the client, in this case, the White House. So I fully expect, and I have reason to believe, that as we speak, FBI officials or DOJ officials are updating the White House real time after each and every interview. Why is that important? Well, if you put it in the context of statements being made emphatically and with great confidence by Senate leaders, GOP leaders, that they're prepared to vote Friday, that this will pass, very confidence-laden statements from the White House and Trump, that this guy will pass, and then strong comments against Dr. Ford last night. If we think of that in the context of the fact that they're being fed the results of interviews real time, one could conclude that they're aware that the interviews are not getting anywhere sufficient. And why is that? In my opinion, because the limitations and the handcuffs are still very, very much on. We keep hearing about expanded scope, but the reality is all we're aware of are two additional interviews beyond the original four permitted interviews. Look, why are we even talking about this? What is an FBI background investigation all about? And every new FBI agent can tell you, whenever they do a background or a spin, they start taking notes by writing an acronym at the top of their note paper. And the acronym is CARLA, or CARLA, which stands for Character, Aptitude, Reputation, Loyalty to the U.S., and Associations. So why is it then that the FBI is not being permitted to do what it does in every standard background investigation, which is to deeply dive into character and reputation and associations? Within character, we absolutely dig into credibility, veracity, truth-telling. We absolutely look at, with aptitude, we look at alcohol abuse and use and drug use. With reputation, we look at whether someone is known to be an offender, an assaulter, belligerent, angry, an angry drunk. And we don't see the White House allowing the FBI to do that. In fact, I would point out two basic disparities or tensions in what we're seeing today. The first disparity or tension is between what could be done by the FBI and what is being permitted for the FBI to do. And there is a huge disparity there because, as you know, the FBI is quite capable of surging tremendous resources into an investigation. Many people have said and asked me, can this really be done in a week? The answer is absolutely. If the FBI goes all hands on deck, full court press, they've done it before, and they're impressive in doing it, activating various field offices from the Baltimore Division to the New Haven Division to Los Angeles Division and beyond, and getting hundreds of interviews done, even setting up tip lines. So that disparity there needs to be pointed out because there's an American naivete that's being exploited by the White House, which is if the White House says it's true, then it must be true. So that brings me to the second disparity or tension, which is what the White House is saying publicly and what's really happening. And what the White House is saying publicly is there's free rein, there's free license, the FBI can interview whoever they want, and much of the American public seems to be accepting that because they want to accept that. But the tension is between that and what's really happening inside the FBI, which is that we're still today on Wednesday at 6 interviews. So where do we go from here? Look, we've already talked on this call about the possibility of public release of the report. I think that in its entirety is very unlikely to happen. But I'm more fascinated by the possibility of what happens down the road. Where's the FOIA request that's going to come in from the media that looks to discover the documentation of communications between the White House and the FBI, including declinations of requests or parameters being established, communications between DOJ and the White House as to how to shape this with the FBI, communications between DOJ and the FBI that might insist on following the instructions from the White House, that might contain declinations and requests for further investigation that isn't being permitted, communications between the Republican senators on the Judiciary Committee and others and the White House, where President Trump has openly conceded publicly that he's doing whatever the Senate wants done. So is the White House acting as a rubber stamp in setting parameters actually established by the Senate? And even more fascinating, the discovery someday of communications within FBI field offices and between FBI field offices and FBI headquarters as to the number and nature of walk-ins and call-ins that are not being addressed, and the tension that goes on between headquarters and the field. The FBI is in the business of documenting everything. Routinely, the FBI on a daily basis has agents who take complaint duty. It's not popular duty, but walk-ins and call-ins have to be addressed and documented, to include walk-ins who say they see Martians in their backyard or their neighbor's a spy, and all of them have to be taken very seriously and documented. But what we're hearing today are reports that walk-ins and call-ins offering information on Judge Kavanaugh are not even being answered. That is not the state of normalcy in the FBI, and that's only because the White House must be telling them, you can't do this. So the discovery of those communications someday, whether through a hearing in a democratically controlled Congress or through FOIA or other means, that's all I've got.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you to all of our speakers. We're going to move into the Q&A session. Just as a heads up to anybody who would like to direct a question to a specific speaker, just please indicate that. And operator, if you could provide instructions, that would be fantastic.
And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. To remove yourself from queue, that is the pound key. Once again, that is the star and one on your touch-tone phone. And we will go ahead and pause for a moment to allow questions to queue. And once again, that is the star and one on your touch-tone phone. We appreciate your patience, and we will take our first question momentarily. And we will go ahead and take our first question from Adam Eldman from NBC Digital. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for hosting the call. I appreciate it. I found your insights valuable. My question, however, is really more about what happens next. Let's say Kavanaugh is confirmed in the next couple of days or week or so. I'm wondering if you guys could all comment on the effect that would have on the integrity of the Supreme Court, and more importantly, on the perception of integrity in the Supreme Court, and then kind of secondarily, what, you know, avenues lawmakers have, and possibly other authorities or members of the Supreme Court itself to remedy those shortcomings.
This is Christine from the Leadership Conference. I think your question goes to exactly what is the standard senators should be looking at. And Robert C. Byrd, during the confirmation hearings debate around Clarence Thomas, had this really important line where he talked about if there's dispute, we should all be thinking about the integrity of the institution, the integrity of the Supreme Court. So we can send you that direct quote because he says it much more eloquently than me, but I think your question goes to the consequence that a confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, especially given how little faith people have in the process of the Senate's vetting of Brett Kavanaugh, the consequence that will have for people's faith in the court as a neutral arbiter. I think what we saw last Thursday in Brett Kavanaugh's testimony was someone belligerent and vindictive and threatening and partisan. So even setting aside the significant sexual assault allegations, that performance was quite revealing, and I have real concerns about how the Supreme Court will be viewed if he is confirmed. Your other part of your question, though, has to do with afterwards what might happen. I think yesterday we saw Representative Nadler talking about the importance of FBI oversight. And I do think that if they do not make public what the directive was for the FBI, I can certainly imagine there will be serious oversight whether the FBI was trying to do its job and was muzzled, or what political interference was made with the FBI doing a fulsome supplemental investigation. So that's one avenue of oversight. I'd imagine there would be other oversight efforts as well.
This is Chris Kang. I just would add one point because I think that covered most of it. But I just want to, again, sort of take us even back before a few weeks ago. I think there already were going to be questions about Brett Kavanaugh's legitimacy, sort of starting with how this whole process unfolded, with President Trump having a short list produced to him by two ultra-conservative interest groups, having a litmus test about overturning Roe versus Wade and gutting the ACA. I think already there were going to be questions about his legitimacy, in particular on those issues. And now the rank partisanship and temperament and everything else you've seen in the intervening sort of last week or two, I think really will just go to undermine that. I think that sort of Ben Wittes, who's been a friend and a supporter of Brett Kavanaugh, sort of made the point that that this is bigger than him. This is bigger than Kavanaugh, and sort of the way that he's put himself forward and tried to defend himself has done such a damage to the Supreme Court that if Kavanaugh were confirmed, I think that's a huge problem for the institution.
And this is Mike Zabransky from the Leadership Conference. I just wanted to chime in to say that the Supreme Court is known as the least dangerous branch of government. And that's because, as Alexander Hamilton explained in the Federalist Papers, that unlike the executive branch and the legislative branch, that the judiciary does not have an army to enforce its rulings, and does not have the bully pulpit to engage the citizenry of the country. But if Brett Kavanaugh gets confirmed, the Supreme Court may also be the least respected branch, given the allegations and the information that we've learned about Kavanaugh over the past few months.
And we will go ahead and take our next question from Jimmy Hoover from Law 360. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I wanted to kind of follow up on that and ask the panel to speak a little bit more specifically about how Kavanaugh's performance at last week's committee hearing has kind of threatened the legitimacy of the court or raised new questions about his fitness for the court. And kind of going off on that, is that something that is going to matter to the, you know, handful of swing vote senators who are ultimately going to decide whether he gets on the court?
This is Chris. I think it absolutely should matter, and I think that it's shown itself to matter a little bit. I think you saw Jeff Flake yesterday say that we can't have that on the court, sort of how nakedly partisan Brett Kavanaugh was, right? And it sort of undermines the entire narrative he's been trying to sell himself, right? When he was even nominated for the D.C. Circuit, Senate Democrats identified the fact that he's a very partisan person. They said, no, I'm not a partisan person. He sort of comes in here to the Supreme Court process, continuing to pretend that he's an umpire who just calls balls and strikes. And then really, last week, we saw he revealed himself to the world that he's really still a partisan hack. And I think that should trouble anybody who thinks about the integrity of the Supreme Court and how it really is supposed to be more independent and above partisan politics, as Brett Kavanaugh himself has said. But also, I think the temperament was astounding. Just watching not just his yelling and screaming and tone, but that exchange he had with Senator Klobuchar, even if Senator Klobuchar had not just talked about her father's struggles with alcoholism, but especially after she did, as she's trying to get to a central fact question in this investigation, whether or not Brett Kavanaugh has blacked out, which could be one of the reasons why he doesn't remember sexually assaulting Dr. Blasey Ford. This is not like some fishing expedition she's on. It's a material fact here. She asks him that question, and his response is, "Have you?" I have never seen a nominee address a senator like that. Setting aside a current judge, setting aside a judge who wants to be elevated to the Supreme Court. And I think that 1 minute exchange in and of itself should be disqualifying because he doesn't have the temperament to be on the court. And I think senators are picking up on that. I think they're talking about it. And I think that could be one of the many things that goes into their calculus as they decide whether or not to oppose his nomination.
This, Christine, I agree with what Chris just said. I also want to remind reporters that Kavanaugh gave this report at Catholic University where he said to be a good judge, it's important to have the proper demeanor, to walk in other shoes, to understand them, to keep their emotions in check. He also mentioned how important it is to not be a jerk and to be a good umpire and a good judge, don't be a jerk. What we saw last Thursday was his temperament was off the charts. I've never seen any witness for any Senate Judiciary Committee hearing act that way. It's clear he was a jerk to senators, plural, not just to Senator Klobuchar, but also to Ranking Member Feinstein and to Senator Whitehouse and others. I've never seen such contempt for the Senate's role in questioning him about his record. That contempt was also shown by his repeated lies under oath. And so when you think about the kinds of cases that come before the Supreme Court, they are only the tough ones, and they often involve the tension between the branches. So the notion that senators would, you know, get a fair trial in front of Judge Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, I think, was completely destroyed by his temperament demonstrated last Thursday. But Chris's earlier point is that we've known for quite a while that he is a political operative, and that plays out in the few records that were released from his time in the Bush White House, and it's no doubt why they were trying to hide his record from those controversial years, especially surrounding George Bush's reelection. I think that one of the main reasons they were hiding that record is because it would have shown more clearly what a political operative he was. And it would have undercut this facade that he's some sort of dispassionate judge. And that certainly, that facade was lifted last Thursday as well.
This is Frank Figluzzi. I want to also touch on the part of that question that goes toward what the swing senators might do and how they might look at this. And I would suggest we ask the question, what would happen if this were a background investigation on one of their staffers who needed a security clearance? And the answer is that if the FBI determined that someone had lied over 20 times in an official capacity, which is being alleged about Kavanaugh during his hearing of matters great and small, and there were allegations multiple that he had sexually assaulted or physically assaulted women, that he might have an alcohol abuse issue or anger management issue, I feel confident saying that that Senate staffer who needs that clearance would not get his clearance. And I would suggest that senators should look at that as one of the lenses they look through.
And once again, to ask a question, that is the star and one on your touch tone phone. And we will go ahead and take our next question from Bill Radin from Capital in Maine. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey, thanks a lot. It's been reported that the Democrats haven't actually asked for a perjury inquiry into Kavanaugh's testimony. Do we have any idea of whether the FBI is actually following up any requests from that side of the aisle?
Well, this is Frank, and while I can't speak with 100% certainty, there's every indication that I'm getting that the lying before Congress perjury issue is not on the list of approved investigative channels for the FBI.
Thank you.
And this is Chris Kang. We at Demand Justice had been calling for a referral to Department of Justice for a perjury investigation after Brett Kavanaugh's initial testimony, sort of the times that he lied and sort of the documents that came out that showed that he lied in 2004 and 2006 in his hearing about things that he was involved in that he claimed he wasn't. So this idea of perjury, I think, has been out there, and we hope that it will be investigated. But even setting aside the fact that I think Frank's right, those questions are probably not going to be on the table, even though we think they should be, I hope that even if they're not looking at it at a perjury from a perjury lens, that they really look at it from a credibility perspective and from a duty of candor perspective as to whether or not Brett Kavanaugh told the truth. I think that people of good faith can say that what Brett Kavanaugh did in his testimony was not perjury, but that it's still disqualifying because it so undermines his credibility. It so undermines his ability to be seen as an impartial judge whose job it will be to determine whether or not other people are being credible and to be in charge of justice and fairness and equality, that those were those reasons they should vote no as well. But so I hope that even though I suspect Frank is right, I hope that even if it's not from a perjury perspective, that they look at these questions. But frankly, that goes back to my earlier point, why I think that we're going to need to see the underlying interviews to know what kinds of questions these FBI agents are allowed to ask and have been asking of these witnesses.
And again, to ask a question, that is the star and one on your touch tone phone. And we'll go ahead and take our next question from Tom Brune from Newsday. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey, thank you for doing this call. Hey, I have a question. There's a tremendous experience on this call in dealing with nominations. And just for context purposes, how did you deal? What was your threshold for nominees who came forward with allegations of some kind of sexual misconduct or abuse? Did you have many of them, and what did you do with them?
This is Frank.
I think that go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'll just briefly hit that, and we can move on. I had such derogatory information at high-level nominees. I have personally briefed the White House on the derogatory. And at that time, the White House gave the green light to do whatever was necessary. And in one case, the most recent case I'm thinking of, a polygraph was mutually agreed upon between the FBI and the nominee. And that polygraph cleared the nominee. And additional interviews were done around the nominee as well. So I would have fully expected that Judge Kavanaugh would not only be interviewed, but that he would be offered a polygraph exam.
And this is Chris Kang. You know, I think one of the things I've been thinking about a lot over the last, in particular, obviously, few weeks, but really as Me Too has really come to the fore, is thinking about how the vetting process has worked and how it can work better in uncovering these allegations of sexual harassment and sexual misconduct. And I think that it's really challenging. We did have, I can think of sort of off the top of my head, at least one incident of sexual misconduct or harassment and another of domestic violence in which we talked to the nominee. We had the FBI go out and pull police records in one case. We talked to other people who were involved in the incident, and at the end of the day made a judgment call. And for one of those candidates, I think the issue was dispositive. For another, it was a contributing factor to not moving forward. And I think that that really underscores at the end of the day, all of this comes down to the president. It comes down to his counsel. It comes down to the people working on these nominees. Do they believe survivors? And what are they going to do about it? We can have all of the vetting in the world. We can have all of the information, the most thorough background investigation. But if the president is still going to move forward a nominee, and if senators are still going to rubber stamp them, then the problem's still going to exist. And I think that that is going to be the much bigger question moving forward, is how are we going to address this on a more systematic level to make sure that people feel comfortable coming forward, that you're able to vet credible claims, and that senators and hopefully the White House will not put them forward in the first place.
This is Christine. And so speaking from the Senate perspective, I just want to add to Chris that I agree that the initial piece is it's up to the president, and different presidents might have different thresholds for what they are comfortable having their nominees have in their background check. But what I would say here, and speaking from the former Senate perspective, is this was often a real decency test for senators. Different senators had different standards, frankly, and when I would brief them on various issues in background reports, there was not one consistent standard of concern, whether it was drug use or whether it was allegations of some other sexual misconduct. But in this case, in the case in front of the Senate right now, this is 100% on the shoulders of senators. Only if they stand up and decide what their standard is going to be for the highest court in the land will it make any difference. And that has as much to do with their institutional role as a co-equal branch of government that is entrusted by the Constitution to independently vet nominees like Brett Kavanaugh, but also their own moral compass. And so I don't think that it's just on one branch or the other. I think it is on both. And I think what we're seeing here is a big test in terms of where senators are and where their standards are for someone who's going to be entrusted with one of the ninth most powerful positions in our country.
This is Mike Zabremski, also from the Leadership Conference, and just wanted to echo the comments of Christine and Chris. And during the Obama administration, working with Chris for several years, I agree with what he said, and there were several people that had sexual misconduct allegations that we learned about through the FBI background investigation process, and those individuals were not nominated. And I believe that if we were vetting someone with the background allegations that Brett Kavanaugh has been accused of, I do not believe he would have been nominated during the Obama administration.
I think that's about all the time that we have. Thank you again for all of our speakers and for everybody joining us. And if you have any additional questions for speakers, please feel free to email us at press@civilrights.org. Thank you.